Roger Allam is one of the UK's most successful actors. Well known as MP Peter Mannion in The Thick of It, the first Javert in Les Miserables, for his Olivier Award-winning performance in Privates on Parade at the Donmar, as Albin in La Cage aux Folles in the West End, and for numerous roles at the RSC in the National Theatre, including in Democracy and Albert Speer. And there have been film roles too, the latest being that of Nicholas Hardiment, lecherous thriller writer in Stephen Frears' film based on Posy Simmons' Tamara Drew. Oh, and not to mention the extremely funny Radio 4 comedy series, Cabin Pressure. But until October the 3rd, Roger Allam will be synonymous with one of Shakespeare's most memorable characters, the Fat Knight Falstaff in Henry IV, Parts 1 and 2 at the Globe. Well, Roger Allam's with me now, Heather Neal, at the Globe, to talk to Theatre Voice before he swaggers on stage once again in a performance of Part 1. And it's extremely hot here, so if there's any background noise, we're trying to cool off in the... with some air conditioning, which seems to be making more a terrible noise, which is a good place to start because it's been terribly hot while you've been playing this and you've had to wear an enormous fat suit because I have to tell the listeners that you're not the same size as the Falstaff we see on stage. But has it been really tough?
It has. It's not as tough now as it was when we were opening in June and July, when we had that incredibly hot weather, when it was sort of, you know, sometimes... I mean, the fat suit, okay, but then... a thick costume on top of that, and then armour on top of that, and then sometimes a cloak. That just makes you feel like crying sometimes. It was so hot. So, you know, you have to drink a lot of water, you have to take rehydration drinks and things like that to make sure you keep the salts in your body and stuff like that. Yeah. You know, 'cause you're just sort of, it just pours off you, really.
So I heard of one performance of Henry VIII where they all got ice lollies in the interval and it became
Yes, we had some of those. We had the ice lollies. We never quite worked out. I thought what a wonderful idea it would be to put some of those freezer packs, put little internal pockets. I'd heard of a previous actor who, in some fat suit job when it was very hot, had done that. But we never got round to it, and then you just get used to it, really. Yeah.
Well, he's not just a funny character, obviously. He's morally reprehensible as well as being a force for life. I rather like the way Simon Sharma summed him up in the FT recently as a magical compound of sweetness and cynicism, animal appetite and sharp-witted philosophy, appalling self-deception and fearless truth-telling. So has it been difficult to keep the balance of humour? Because the audience always love Falstaff, but they're always, also they should be a bit anxious about what he stands for, shouldn't they?
Well, I mean, I think that's one of the glories of the plays and of the character, in that there are an awful lot of balls you have to keep in the air with Falstaff. The thing is, you never really see him. You never witness the worst thing he does, which is to lead his soldiers into a place where they're killed. Although, of course... Hotspur does exactly the same thing, really. It's just that through the character of Falstaff, the audience experiences that very clearly ironic voice, you know, the one who gives no value to the notion of honour at all. So I don't think, and you see him rob, but it's not a tremendously successful robbery, you see him really, I suppose someone described him, I don't know who it was, as one of those sort of id-led characters. He has no super ego, although he occasionally goes through these, very very occasionally goes through periods of saying, well, I must lead a better life, I must and I will, and then never does. So I just think really that you have to, instead of trying to control all those things, you just have to let them all out, let them be there, you know, because a character is as much the sum of what he does, the sum of his actions and how he behaves, than as anything else, you know, any kind of controlling thing that the director and the actor can put on it. Although, having said that, of course, there's, you know, you can give different emphasis to things, and in a different production, who knows, in a different space, the emphasis might be subtly different or hugely different. Yeah. I don't know.
Well, I've seen it a couple of times, and part one, that is, and I've seen, and on both occasions there was an audible intake of breath when you steal the ring off the corpse of Bernard, isn't it?
It's Walter Blunt.
Obviously that's a production choice not to do with the text, so that's clearly one way of showing something.
But it's, you know, it's not, well, in my mind it doesn't seem to be that terrible. It's a tiny thing, really, you know. Yeah. I mean, you know, that's a, I mean, he has a very, very realistic view of war and and what war is, and also he's obsessed. You know, you get the sense that he has the title but no substance, no land. He's obsessed with land, with getting land. I mean, he says, you know, you could buy land now as cheap as stinking mackerel, so if only you had the money, you could buy the land. And later, in part two, he says of Justice Shallow, and now this vice's dagger has land. Mm. Beefs, they have the substance. And he's also obsessed with the figure of £1,000. Something, yeah. If only he could get £1,000, he would have the substance that would sort of set him up somehow. Yeah. In a better life.
And he does manage to get it from Shallow.
He gets it from Shallow, but immediately he's taken to prison. Yeah. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Well, does he ever get any insight into what's happening? Does he in some part of himself realise what Hal is up to? In part one particularly, where, you know, I will, for instance, yes, when he says that line about getting rid of all the friends from the tavern. Does any of that somewhere creep into Falstaff's consciousness?
Well, I suppose it's an anxiety somewhere, you know, but as far as Falstaff is concerned, Hal loves him, you know, adores him, and they have a wonderful time together. And you don't get the sense in part two that is in his mind anymore.
No.
That fear that he'll be banished. You know, completely the opposite. His first thought is that he will now be of enormous importance.
Yeah. So he's deceiving himself, or is he entirely deceived by Hal? I mean, he obviously sees himself as his father in a sense, doesn't he?
I don't know whether he sees himself as his father, you know.
Father substitute.
You know, I mean, it's difficult because so much is written about Falstaff, and you can't say that the character has read the stuff that's been written about Falstaff, you know.
No, have you? Did you?
Yes, I went through quite a lot of it. Yes, and dipped into it. But
is anything really helpful? I mean, you've just got to face what.
Oh, of course, it's all helpful. Anything that stimulates you is helpful. Yeah. You know, I mean, that book, The Falstaff Myth, about all the kind of mythic characters in different cultures that a Falstaff kind of character has a link with.
And the idea of the vice in the morality play.
Absolutely, you know, that's all useful, but in the end, you can't sort of play that, because then you're playing something else other than that's somehow bubbling away in the subconscious of the subconscious of the play, in a sense, or in the
universe.
Yes,
I suppose that's what I meant.
The universe of the play, really, you know.
Yeah.
And yes, I mean, all that is there, yes, to be touched in. You know.
Part one and part two are quite different in feel, aren't they? Is there much difference in Falstaff? I mean, he's clearly experiencing life in a different way. He's seeing himself as old by part two, isn't he?
Yes, I'm not. I mean, you know, I mean, in any kind of real sense, he can't be that much older because But yes, that sort of comes to the fore.
It's less playful, isn't it? He's not.
Yes, the pub scene is certainly less. less fun. It's more that there is more about death. You're absolutely right. But the, you know, his first scene, he's absolutely on the up, even though he talks about his diseases and stuff at the end, and it's a sort of dazzling display, really, of wit and language. That first scene, that's one of the hardest things about part two, I think, for me, is that that first scene is so virtuosic in a way, and then you never quite have that again until his first scene in our second half of part two, I suppose, with John of Lancaster and Colville of the Dale. There's a bit of that there, but you know. But the main difference, I suppose, between part two and part one is part two has far less focus on a kind of narrative drive. Part one is very is brilliantly simple in a way. In a way, it juxtaposes these three worlds: the world of the rebel, the world of the court, and the world of Falstaff and the pub. Part two is far more slippery in terms of narrative drive. There isn't a big battle that everything is building up to. There are almost not quite Jacobian scenes, but certainly they seem almost like something out of, I don't know, a Bulgakov play or a Russian play, you know, in the shallow scenes, the Gloucestershire scenes. That's the difficulty, I suppose, keeping. I imagine it must be very difficult for an audience to see part two without seeing part one, whereas part one, in a sense, can exist in its own right.
Yes,
you know.
Yes, and nobody knows quite why there are two parts, were they?
It's hugely successful, you know.
Yes, but part one seems to lead part two, though, in a sense, don't you?
Well, yes, I suppose he leaves himself that option because the story isn't finished.
Yeah. And in part two, of course, we get something of what Falstaff was like when he was young, which is slightly embarrassing to him, perhaps, talking to Shallow.
Yes, I don't know whether it's embarrassing, really. Yes.
Well, because he still sees himself as much younger than them.
Younger than them. Yes. Well, I suppose he is younger than them.
But certainly.
But it's and again, you never quite know. When Shakespeare uses numbers, whether maybe he was hopeless at maths, Shakespeare, because you know, Shallow says, I say of the men we're recruiting, is here all? And Shallow says, here are two more than you can have. You must have but four, and we've only seen five.
Yeah.
So you know, should there have been another recruit, or is it just a mistake, or? Was he writing that first thing in the morning, you know, and hadn't woken up? It's odd. So when Silent says it's 55 years ago, maybe it is, you know, maybe that makes when
Jane Knightwerk's son
is John Falstaff would have been page to Thomas Mowbray.
Yeah.
That would make him at the youngest in his late 60s.
Yeah.
But then you sort of think,
but he's still
going
to
really,
battle. Yeah.
Would he really be in charge? Would he really have a charge of foot soldiers, in charge of 150 foot soldiers in a battle in his late 60s? Probably not. So you don't know, really. You don't quite know.
Well, you mentioned the language. I think everything you say in prose?
There's a sort of couple of... There's a few little couplets of verse, but very, 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 very small. Most of it is this very dense and dazzling prose.
Yeah.
Very hard to learn.
Is
of course,
it?
Because you haven't got the...
You haven't got the rhythm,
of the verse, which is an aide memoir, you know.
Mm. But it must be fascinating, though, with all the images and the...
It's absolutely wonderful. So I think it's one of the most attractive things about Falstaff, is just the brilliance of his... of his wit and of his lying and his escaping out of things and
his imagination.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's the most attractive thing about him.
in a sense, his trickster-like kind of ability to escape the consequences of his actions until the very end.
Yeah. Well, the Globe audience is unlike any other audience, I think, isn't it? And partly because you can see them, obviously.
Yeah.
And I think you use them as your recruits.
Yes, we do. Yes, we use some of them as the recruits. And that kind of... that just seems inevitable. And once you're standing there and you see everybody, you know, in daylight, it just seems it would seem unnatural to try and shut the audience out. It would be a very... and it's that... it's a form of theatre that's very like kind of... playing. I notice my sons when they play, they're constantly stepping in and out of character, writing it as they go along, directing it, acting in it, and it's the most natural, it seems the most natural thing in the world to them to be able to do that. And it's sort of similar here, I think.
Did you enjoy it when you first stepped on that stage?
Yes.
Some people find it rather frightening, don't they?
Oh no, I didn't find it frightening.
Oh, well.
I mean, I've done quite a number of things that have and played a number of characters that have sought contact with the audience. So
yes.
I'm used to that anyway. I just think the pillars are in the wrong place.
Yes, the pillars are a nuisance, aren't they? Where would you put them? Just
further upstage.
Yeah.
They're about 5 foot further upstage. You wouldn't have, I don't think, hardly any, 5 or 6 foot. I don't think you'd have any sightline problems.
Yes. Your set is a kind of reminder of what it must have been like when people played in yards before there was a theatre. The way it's built.
The sort of scaffolding.
Scaffolding, yes.
Yes, yes. I suppose so, yeah.
Yeah. Is it tempting to play more to the audience? Your character...
They're always there. I mean, you know, there are very obvious occasions when you're talking to the audience because you're standing alone on stage and there's no one else there. But they can be appealed to, at any time, really. I think you have to be careful. You can't play all to them.
Yeah.
You know.
Yes, the Falstaff does enjoy playing a role, he likes an audience anyway, doesn't he?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, they're just another audience.
Yes.
You know, there's already an audience on stage,
yeah.
And there's another one
watching
him.
Although, of course, we do get his honour speech, which is just not for anyone else on stage.
No, but, I mean, it's for the audience there.
Yes, so we do get an insight into his head there as well.
Yes, which he doesn't... He doesn't say anything like that to anyone on stage.
No.
No, he doesn't.
No. Here, when he's rejected, people seem to be genuinely horrified and shocked... is that something you'd... is a surprise? Do you think people haven't taken on board that? Because Hal's intimation that he's going to do that in part one is quite underplayed here, isn't it? It's not made too much of when he says, "I know you all." That's very quietly done. So we do build up to a real rejection, which... people seem to be surprised at still.
Yes, I mean, I'm not quite sure what they think Hal should have done. Should he have made Falstaff Lord Chief Justice? You know? And we've already seen Hal make it up with the Lord Chief Justice before that last scene, so...
It should be
shocking.
Yeah.
It should be shocking. Because, you know, the most fun that Hal has had, and presumably the audience have had, has been with Falstaff.
Yeah.
So it's sort of like you're turning your back on fun, and warmth.
Well, the centre of all that, of course, is the tavern scene where they exchange roles, which is wonderfully, wonderfully done. Is that fun to play, especially especially when you take on the role of Hal before his father?
Yes, I didn't. That was another thing. I didn't really know how. When I'm playing his father.
When you take on Hal's father.
Yes, I didn't really know how to do that until we started performing it, really, and then it just. Then it just emerged from that, really.
Yeah, because you can satirise him at the same time.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Is that was that the scene that you worked on longest, or was it?
I think all the big scenes with a lot of scenes with a lot of people in them always take longer because there's just more and also you don't know what you're doing. There's just an awful lot to arrange and work out, and who's doing what, where and when.
Around the pillars.
Yeah, around the pillars, absolutely, yes.
Yes, it looks particularly enjoyable, though, that the way you play, using the cushion for a crown and so on, I mean, all these things, do they come up in rehearsal? This, how much just arrives when you're doing it?
Well, I mean, it's all there in rehearsal. I mean, and it's all there in the script. I'll use this stool and this dagger and this cushion. And then various things. That's terrible, really. Picking one's nose with the dagger, therefore with the scepter. Only came out in performance because I realised that the whole thing about pitch, which has some sort of sexual illusion that the Elizabethans would have picked up and would maybe have found screamingly funny, is something that simply isn't available to us.
No.
So that little passage just needs a little bit of help somehow, and that's where I suddenly saw the dagger, there it was, very handy, and it also seemed an outrageous thing to do with the thing that was standing in for the scepter.
So that bit actually came in during performance?
Yes, I think in previews, yes. Yeah. Or maybe I did it in rehearsal, I can't remember now.
Yeah.
I can't actually remember. I've got a feeling it came in early performance.
Has it changed much then? Do you add
still? The mime of Hal, when I'm doing Hal, that came in performance.
Oh.
Because I was thinking, my imitation of Hal is a bit dull, and he hasn't got much to say as Hal before he goes into sort of appealing about Falstaff, as Hal, I suppose. And the grabbing the cushion off on Depose Me, that came in performance as well.
Right.
Sometimes sometimes you get encouraged along things like that if it's going particularly well,
Yeah.
And it just happens.
Yeah. So when you rehearsed, did you do a lot of sitting around talking first? Was that?
Yes, there's a certain, or as always, you have to go through the text. And the process with Dominic was just to sort of make sure we knew exactly what was being said.
Did you deal to begin with both plays at once, knowing the whole story from beginning to end?
Yes, we did. Yeah, we rehearsed them both. We sort of went through both plays at least twice, and then concentrated on part one. And then when we got part one up and performing, went back to part two and went through part two again. Yeah. Probably three times, once around the table and twice on our feet.
Right.
Yes.
And do you have a bad weather version? I mean, I know some productions have to have different versions when there's a lot of fighting or running about.
Just have to be careful.
They don't leak bits
really
out. You've been fairly lucky with the weather, haven't
not
you?
Not too bad. There was on press night, there was a sort of huge downpour in part one. I think we just have to be careful. Particularly with the fighting in part one. Part two isn't nearly so bad from that point of view, you know, from the fighting point of view.
Is there a physical change in Falstaff by part two? I mean, I know he hasn't got much older, but we do feel that he's more tired. Or
do you?
Well, he's facing death more than he wanted to in part one. I mean, he says he's young, doesn't he? Or that he's one of the young.
In part two, he says he's one of the young. So,
but he's playing with the young still in part one.
And also with his page in part two.
Yeah.
I suppose he gets pulled into, it's sort of, yes.
But his page is bringing him news from the doctor and
that's
so on.
That's true, it's not great news.
No.
Yeah. Yes, and he doesn't see Hal so much in part two. So, but to me, there isn't, to me it doesn't feel like doing it. There's a huge physical change, right. You know. Again, I think partly because the first scene, first two scenes really, but certainly the first scene with the Lord Chief Justice is so dazzling and so confident and so outrageous that although there are these worries about illnesses and the state of one's urine and things like that, it's overshadowed by the, you know, he ends that first saying, good wit will make use of anything, I will turn diseases to commodity.
It has been said that although Falstaff is enormous in the play in every sense, it's England that's, as it were, the real star. And we do see all sorts of aspects of the whole country, don't we? All classes and different parts
of the
country.
Well, I think that's the glory of the plays,
yeah.
Really, the way they...
Both of them.
Both of the plays. The way they just seem to effortlessly be able to encompass the whole of that world, you know. In a way that you don't often see in plays, not really.
No, it's rather nice that the programme's actually got maps to show us just how much of the country,
yeah.
and indeed of London particularly.
Yeah.
So you didn't think of Shakespeare as a London writer mostly, but...
Well, no,
he is.
Although, you know, I mean, there are certain lines in the plays in which you kind of think, well, only a country boy would have thought of that, none of those university wits.
Well, you mentioned your research a bit earlier. I mean, some people have said that Falstaff is based on the old Vice and the Morality plays, but also on real people. Of course, Oldcastle at one stage was actually had the name in the play,
yes.
And Shakespeare had to remove that because the family objected because he was actually a martyr. But there's also a playwright, isn't there?
Robert Greene,
yes. Who was a rival,
Who was one of the who was very self-destructive and scurrilous and died young, though not old like Falstaff. Famously insulting, he would have used a lot of flighting, I'm sure. Robert Greene, and he lived around here, I think.
Yes, he was a dissolute character, but not from gentleman stock like Falstaff.
Although I can't remember what his background was.
I think he came from quite a poor background, but he was better educated.
Yes. Yes, I mean, all those things are, again, interesting and useful strands, but you can't play him as Sir John Oldcastle, you know. Falstaff is nothing like, as far as we know, the real Sir John Oldcastle. Although there are that he does speak a certain strange puritanical biblical language sometimes.
Yeah.
There are other ways in which he's Falstaff is old, and Robert Greene was 30 something or other when he died, I believe.
Although Shakespeare didn't mind messing about with that sort of thing, did he?
Hotspur
and Hal were not anything like
that. There was another Sir John
Fastolf,
I think, as well. He was a military man who was wrongly accused of cowardice. Now, you know, these are things that are all interesting to look at, but in the end, you know... And the audience then might have picked up on a number of those things, you know. But that doesn't mean to say that Falstaff
is any one of those characters, or indeed even all of them. You know, Falstaff is I suppose, you know, a creation of Shakespeare's imagination, enriched by, you know, one imagines, enriched by a certain knowledge of, say, Robert Greene, and also reading about Sir John Oldcastle and stuff. It's difficult to think of Falstaff as a Protestant martyr, I have to say.
Well, before you began this, I believe Patrick Stewart said to you helpfully that this was the middle-aged man's Hamlet. And has it felt like that? Has it felt like an enormous undertaking?
Well, yes, it's certainly, you know, it's a big beast of a part to play. And
you have indeed, about 20% of the lines.
Yes, you do, yeah. And indeed, in the sense that, certainly in another sense, in the way that Hamlet is a long meditation on death, you know, by a through the mouth of a younger character. Certainly, you can see, there's certainly that rich strand in Shakespeare as in Falstaff as well, and just in the sense that it's a very, very rich character, so that in the performing of it, you never feel you're done with it. You never feel that it's finished. You know.
So you don't mind the thought of having to go on stage and do it again in a minute?
No.
I better let you get off and do that. So thank you very much. For people who still would like to come and see it, and there's still plenty of opportunity, go to shakespeares-globe.org.